So we're in Romans chapter 10. I will tell the lesson. I do know the lesson. We can go through it and everything. I just don't have that real fun handouts for you this morning. I'm going to confess to you that there have been a few times Bev and I get in the car and she says, why haven't you told them about what's going on in our life and ask them to pray? And I said, well, I just don't want to dominate. You know, I'm teaching all that stuff. So right now, it's not major. It's just, you know, in when you walk with the Lord and you're in ministry, you're in that constant state of asking the Lord, am I where you want me to be? Is this where you want me to be effective? And at times when you're in a ministry and you begin to see, I don't feel like I'm as effective as God would have me. I don't feel like what I have to offer is being utilized. I feel like there's some things I could do. You begin to just prayerfully, on a regular basis, go to the Lord and say, give me insight. Is this what you want? Bev and I are going through a season of that right now. We're in good position at a school, but we're really praying, Lord, is this really the school that you want us to continue? Because some things have occurred at the school, in our life, things of that nature that we're just praying. So if we happen to come to your mind, just pray for us. We want God's will. That's all we want. We're beginning to explore, is there another place that you want us? I will tell you, we've made the determination we're not leaving Dallas. This is where our grandkids are. We have chosen to stay here. So our question is there a school that we might be able to serve more in line with what we believe as far as strong Christian education? And is that just what the Lord has? So if you just, we're going through that right now, and it's not tumultuous for us. It's just a prayerful season of uncertainty and just praying for God's wisdom in that to give to us. So that would be a prayer we would cover.
Huh? How old are your children? Where do you live?
We live in a place we would prefer to be farther. All of our life is south. We're in Salina right now.
South Oklahoma.
Yeah, South Oklahoma. And the ministries that have been open to us are this way. The church, which we are delighted to be back here. But if you don't know, you are the delight of my week. Just want to tell you that. You are the delight of my week. I look for that all the time. So we would love to be farther south. Our kids are farther south. When we came from Boston, from a school that was great, we made the decision to come be around our grandkids. We made that decision. We were not going to be those absentee grandparents that just showed up. You know, that was for us. That's what we decided. And so we came back. The Lord opened a door, and then that ministry closed, and another one. And so we've just kind of been a little bit of a unsettled, not really unsettled, but just transition, if you will. And so so we would love to move farther south. We feel like the ministry is farther south. We have no intention of leaving Grace anymore. This is where we're staying from now on. Because I don't know if you know or not, my first ministry in Texas was Grace Bible Church with the youth here. Yep. And so it's really, it's got a special place for us. Bev grew up in this church, by the way. I don't know if you knew that or not. She grew up, she was known as the number two kinsman daughter. You know, because there were four of them. They didn't know their names. There were just one, two, three, and four. She was the number two kinsman daughter. So anyway, cover your prayers in that. In education, you often try things out that you believe are going to work well. And then you evaluate it. So I'm going to attempt. I had this brain teaser that I've used for kids to stretch their critical thinking. And the other day, when I was thinking through this brain teaser, this question, I realized it has a direct correlation, or as an illustration, to the discussion we've had about God's sovereign choice and man's choosing, how those two fit together. So you're going to be the first group I'm going to try this on, okay? And we're going to see if it does give any insight or help. Now, I'm keenly aware this could be abysmal failure. I am keenly aware of that. So we're going to give it a shot. So here it is. There are two truths, and I have to set it up in light of the principle of God's sovereign choice and man's choosing. There are two principles that we use in mathematics, addition and subtraction. And they work together, but you can't define the one by the other. Okay? They're two different veins that work in mathematics. And there are rules within mathematics of how they can properly be used. And if you use them improperly, you don't get the right solution. That's the setup. Okay, you ready? Here it is. Three gentlemen go to a hotel. They walk into the hotel. You've heard this, Arnie?
Of course.
Of course. They walk into a hotel, And when they go in the hotel, they want a room for the night, and the clerk behind the counter says it's $30 a night. And so each of these men go, well, that's easy. We each give $10, and that'll pay the $30. So they each pay $10, and they go to their room. The clerk checks his book and goes, oh, it's $25 a night, not $30. I need to get the $5 back to him. So he calls the bellhop. The bellhop comes to him. He gives him the $5, says, you need to take this up to the three guys in the room. The bellhop leaves, goes up to the room, and he realizes, how can they divide $5? They can't. He has a solution. He decides he's going to keep two of the dollars, and he's going to give each of them $1 back. So he gives each of them $1 back. So now each of those men, since they paid 10 to start with, right, and they got $1 back, that means each of them paid $9, which is 27. And the bellhop has two. That's 29. What happened to the other dollar? You're chuckling. What I've done, basically,
Abbott and Costello.
You've sent us down a whole rabbit trail. I've sent you down.
The idea here is that if I explain it based on where I subtract in a few of the equation, then I jump to the sum, and then I go back with addition, and then I jump back to the negative, and so forth. The point is, if I violate the rules of mathematics, and I don't keep the two in their proper place, and I try to integrate them together in ways they were never intended to be used, I don't come out with the same sum. And so I use that as an illustration when we talk about God's sovereign choice and will. It's operating over here. Man's free will, it's very true. And I think at times, theologically, potentially, we might jump back and forth, picking this element here and this one, and then when we try to put them together, we don't come out with the same sum.
The simple one there is the bellhop's $2 is not the difference between what they paid and what they originally.
That's correct.
It's the difference between what they paid and what the,
yes.
What the keep the owner got.
Yes, that's exactly right. The point I'm trying to make is when you jump out and it does it not appear logical? I mean, they each paid $9, that's 27, and he has two, so I come out with 29. Now I'm missing one, and somehow I got two. Okay, that was my illustration for you today. Okay? What's that?
Where can you get these rooms for $30?
Yeah, where can you get a room for $30? That's the bigger question. Right, exactly.
Not even Motel 6 anymore.
Very true.
Show us how that relates, though.
Oh, how it relates? Yes, my intent is the point I make is if on one hand you had God's sovereignty and the other you have man's choice, and you begin to define it here, and then you jump over and grab a principle of man's choice and try to bring it back this way, and then you try to add those two together, you come out with a different sum. That was the point I was trying to make. So did it work or did it fail?
It worked.
Okay. We are stepping now into chapter 10. Remember, 9 through 11 is focused on Israel.
But you might want to preface it with an easier illustration for the age group that you're working with. See, we know about Abbott and Costello.
Okay. You know who's on first and on what's on second, and I don't know who's on third. And the
psych. I'm sorry, I'm an educator.
There you go. You connected with that. What I thought we'd do today is I'm going to break this into the sections I would normally have on the screen for you and kind of look at it. As always, I think it's advantageous to kind of give us that ground that we're coming into, keep it in context. So if you remember, we end chapter 8 with that great statement, nothing can separate you from the love of God. There is now no condemnation. That security that we have in our faith is well established as we come to the end of chapter 8. We are also called in chapter 8, are we not? That it is not just the security that we have, but there's a responsibility and an obligation out of gratitude for what he's done to live a holy life. That we are supposed to be putting to death the deeds of the flesh, the sin, those things. So there is not this sense of security without a correct response on our behalf. We get to chapter 9, and if you remember, he changes his context, and he starts to begin to talk about the nation of Israel. He gives us his sincere compassion for them. And the predominant thing out of chapter 9 that comes to us is that salvation is not a birthright. The nation of Israel was looking at their connection with the Old Testament covenants, with what God had done, and they were starting to claim that the only way that you could come to salvation had to be through them, through the Israel nation. And we talked about the context of the church is Gentiles coming flocking to this gospel message, and Israel was rejecting it. They were rejecting it because they saw it in a different way. And so the 9 through 11 is addressing that overall context. Chapter 9, the point he drives home is the fact it is God's sovereign choice that salvation even exists. And that the nation of Israel, and he goes through their history, even you as a nation know that it's by his sovereign choice that he chose Abraham. And it wasn't just all children, it was one child of Abraham. And it wasn't just children from one mother, because even in what you have the split between Jacob and Esau. And so he's driving the point that there is God's sovereign choice. And of course, we hit that tough spot when it talks about God hardens who he will, God softens who he will. And the idea there is simply that there is no limit to his sovereign rule. It extends into everything. It's not just in one vein. Okay? Now we come to chapter 10, and again, he's going to begin this by reconnecting his passion and love for Israel, and he's going to give them a quality that didn't end up where they desired. Let's look at that. 10, 1 through 4. I did have, my Bible was in that pack, so I had to go borrow a Bible out of the pew in church to be ready for today. So this is the NIV. It says, "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. For I can testify about them that they are zealous for God, but their zeal is not based on knowledge. Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Christ is the end of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes." I think he brings out two key points. Have you ever had somebody who is zealously wrong? They will not move. They believe in it, but you know it's wrong. And Paul clearly says that zealousness is not a criteria for salvation. Truth is. So Israel can be as zealous as they want to be in belief in what they have, but it does not change their destiny. Their destiny is tied to faith. So he's pointing to that. One of the commentators said that, and I can't give you the full history of this in a class like this, but it's quite interesting that he connects that in the recent past is when the zealots came to power and they were trying to fend off Rome because they saw Rome as the incarnate evil and they were trying to reestablish, and the zealots were truly passionate and had great zeal, which zealots comes from, great zeal for the nation of Israel. And so he's might be referring to that historical reference of the zeal of the nation for God. They're zealous for God, but their zealousness is not with true knowledge, and it's not in line with the truth. And therefore, it does not attain what they were looking for, which he points to is the righteousness. If we go back to what we talked about in chapters 3, 1 through 3, that righteousness means to stand right, be in the right place with God. The contrast between righteous and unrighteous. You're either in the right place with God or you're out of that right place. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to say that I went to Israel a couple of months ago, and I happened to talk to 3 different Israeli women, and they are passionate about God. God and us, God and me, God and me. They were stubborn. 2 of the women said, "We are stubborn." And I wasn't proselytizing, I was looking for jewelry, actually. And she just went on about God's relationship. And so she was definitely zealous. Both of these 2 women said almost the same thing. I was really shocked. I said, well, what about Jesus? She just said, oh, he's not that important, you know, he was a prophet.
Israel will take Christ and will move him to a level of a prophet, but they will never... Because we had a speaker once in college who was from a Jewish background, and it was interesting. He said, he literally just said to the congregation, we were all college students in chapel, and he said, if I believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, I would be a Christian. I'm not a Christian. I don't believe he's the Messiah. So his doctrine is, he looks at Christ, and he basically was saying, based on his understanding of what he studied, he said Christ is a prophet, a good prophet, a good man. Have you ever heard C.S. Lewis's Lord Liar Lunatic? I mean, that's the key in that. You know, Christ claimed to be God. He either was or he knew he wasn't and claimed to be, which made him a liar, which means he's not a good man. or he had delusions of grandeur and thought he was God when he wasn't, and that doesn't make him a good man. So the argument, C.S. Lewis would say, the argument of saying Christ was a good man is refuted in his claims, because he claimed to be God, and if he wasn't God, then he's not a good man because he was either crazy or he was lying to you, and that would take him out of that. So in this one...
I'm sorry, they don't read their Bibles either, and they don't even have the New Testament.
Well, no, they would not look at the New Testament because they would see it outside of it.
They told me they don't really read it like we do. It's kind of given to them.
Yeah, from the rabbis, yeah. And if they were trained, they would have been trained in the Torah, in the Old Testament. And the explanation would be they're still looking for, they are still looking for the prophesied Messiah.
Yeah, they are.
Still waiting.
Bob, that's true of a lot of other people, too.
Yeah.
You deal with the Catholic Church, which for years you had to get the Bible from the priest for years and years until, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't that many years before that. Most of them couldn't read anything.
That's true.
The only way you were going to get it.
That's true.
In fact, most of our history, that's true.
That is true. And when we went, it was really interesting. When I took high school students into Italy and we went to Assisi, and we went into St. Francis Chapel in Assisi, we had a monk who was telling us about the frescoes that were in there. And he basically looked and he pointed to all of them and he said, all these up here are the poor man's Bible. And he said, look at them. And you did. And what it was the Old Testament story depicted in major scenes of the Old Testament. And it moved from the front to the door. And at the door was the resurrection and the... And he said, the poor man's Bible was, here's the foundation of your faith, now go tell it to the world. Oh. It was fascinating. It was really neat to see that.
In the children's wing, we have the same thing. We
have
the pictures of all the Bible stories.
It's also that way in Paris, in St. Chapelle, they have all of the books of the Bible
and
the different stories that are done in the same class.
Yeah, and you're right, it wasn't that long ago in which that, and then when the Gutenberg Bible came out, the whole discussion was the poor man you don't put the Bible in their hands because they don't know how to interpret it.
And I guess we've somewhat proven this.
Yes, there is.
And this is going to sound crazy, but I think it will help save, people from totally disbanding from Christianity. But I was just thinking right now, since I'm a school librarian, maybe we should graphic novel the Bible.
Oh, any method in order to get the story out, yeah. Just don't put him in a cape. Just don't put him in a cape. That'd be a little too far.
I've actually gave it to a friend of mine, but someone has gone through and done a Lego version of the Bible.
Okay.
Where all the people are Legos, and you have not lived until you've seen a Lego Christ crucified.
Oh, yeah.
They just have them up like this. I'm just thinking, that's just a little wrong.
Yeah, there are some things that seem, cross the line a little bit. In the text, though, you've got zealous is one. So he recognized their zeal, but their zeal is not based on the truth. He concludes that this zeal has caused them to create their own path of righteousness, and that's what he means. They've created their own path to be right with God. Now, you should couple something with that. It's that they created this path, which would indicate that it was not a path that God had ever designed for man to be right with him. And Paul's going to argue that later on, that the path for righteousness has always been by faith. And his argument is going to be that even when the law was given, you had to approach the law by faith in order to be right with God. Okay? Okay? So don't miss the fact that he says they created a path of righteousness that was their own. It wasn't that the path of righteousness changed, okay? But they created their own path, which was not God's path, which was by faith. And then he's going to end that by culminating it in, verse 4, where he says, Christ is the end of the law so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. And that's the crux of what he's going to do in chapter 10. Christ is the end of the law. Doesn't mean the end or the removed, but it's the fulfillment. It is the apex. It is that which the law designed us to draw to. Now, I do want to draw you Greek words oftentimes give me chills sometimes when I get connections. That word end is from the Greek word telos, which is also connected to the same word when Christ was on the cross and he said, telestai. It's different forms of it, but it's the same word. So when he drank the sour wine and said, it is finished, that's telestai. That's the same root word you have here is translated as end, telos.
Paid in full.
Paid in full. Well, telestai means it is done, it is finished, it is completed. And the primary thing to recognize coming on Easter is you should never miss the point that he willingly gave up his life. At that point, it says he gave up. So it is not, now, why he went through all the torture, they actually put him on the cross, but they did not kill him. He gave his life voluntarily. And that account on the cross is important for us to realize. Remember, he could have called angels down to his stead. He could have done whatever he wanted to not go through that. And yet he said, it is finished. I've paid it in full. I've suffered. And now I give up my spirit. Mm-hmm. Full control, never out of control, always a willful choice through the entire process. And he gave it. I called my brother the other day and he said, which I hadn't thought about, but he said, he's been studying the word. He's in Oregon and he's been in mission field in France, loves the Lord, passionate about Christ, and we get sometimes great conversations on the phone. He said what he has turned to recently, he says, do we realize that Christ is the only one who decided to take on and become a human? None of us have that choice. He is the only one who willingly said, I will become this. And he's just, his whole study in that has been interesting, but it's just kind of a, in a glorified body. Yes. Yes.
Probably I was thinking about Galatians 2:20 and the ending phrase in there says he delivered himself up.
Yes.
So
again, affirmation of that.
He's in control.
We didn't kill him and then it accomplished. It's that in that process, he gave himself
he
up. He laid it down. He gave it up. He did it. Yes.
Why? Is it because he was being obedient to the Father?
Absolutely. We get that in the garden with the cup. And recently did a study on that cup, and it's quite, share a few things with you. In the garden, when Christ took the cup willingly, Arthur Pink says it's as if the cup was lowered before him from heaven, and he looked in and saw the absolute putrid stench of sin. And by seeing that, it caused him to, it wasn't the cross he was going to. It wasn't the pain he was going to go through. It was that the holy, pure Son of God was to take that on. Mm. And when it talks about him falling to the ground, if you have ever had a situation that caused you such grief that involuntarily your body responds by collapsing, that's what he experienced in the flesh. I saw that one time when we had a mother whose second grade child was killed in a four-wheel drive thing. He was tipped over and it caused, I won't go into details, but he was in the hospital and the school rallied to them and we were praying for his health and well-being. And I remember looking down the hallway as she was standing out of the door where her child was being treated and saw the doctor come out and tell her that he had passed, that he was no longer. Mm. I saw that grief. She dropped to the floor in anguish, not voluntarily, involuntarily, dropped to the floor. That's the image that that word in the text gives us of what Christ did. When he saw that sin to take it on, he dropped. He sweated drops of blood. And he says to the disciples, I am at the brink of death. I am at the edge. He almost, get this, he almost died at that point just from taking our sin. Before he was whipped, before a thorn pierced his brow, he was in the depths of grief based on what he had to take on. Okay? And he did it willingly. And that you said, and it says in that text, he's at that point in his life, and he almost begs the Father, Father, if it is at all possible, can we do this another way? That's what he's saying. Mm-hmm. Is there another way besides me taking that cup?
And carrying that heavy cross.
Yeah. And he says, but not my will, but your will be done. And he was obedient. So that is the telestai, that is the end, that is the fulfillment of the law. That's what he's drawing at. So the contrast, he starts chapter 10, the zealousness of the Jews without knowledge, and Christ being the telos, the end, the fulfillment of the law. So he's basically gospel and law, the contrast between the two. The law is a righteousness of your own if you think that's how you're... And now the rest of the text is going to delve into that a little bit. You probably should have noticed that Paul presents kind of a thesis statement, if you will, and then he goes on to kind of explain it. And since he's talking to Jews, where is he going to go to show the validity of his argument? The Old Testament. He's going to pull passages from the Old Testament, just like he did in chapter 9, to validate his thesis. Okay? So 5 through 13, okay? 5 through 13 is a direct contrast between the gospel and the law. Okay? So look in verse 5. It says, Moses describes it in this way, the righteousness that is by the law, the man who does these things will live by them. But the righteousness that is by faith, do not say in your heart, who will ascend to heaven? For this is to bring Christ down. Or who will descend into the deep? That is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith we are proclaiming. That if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For it is with the heart that one believe, that you believe, and are justified, and it is in the mouth that you confess and are saved. As the scripture says, anyone who trusts in him will never be put to shame. For there is no difference between Jew and Gentile. The same Lord is the Lord of all and richly blesses all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Now he refers to Moses, and so he goes to Deuteronomy with these passages. The very first one that he uses, well, first I think he says, if you're going to try to find righteousness through the law, then you live by that. And so it's like, if you're choosing this, you live by it, the outcome is you won't make it. It's like, if you choose it, you got to live by it and the outcome of it. And then then he says, the man who does these things shall live by them. But then he says, but the righteousness that is by faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? Now, the passage where he says, this is where my notes would have been helpful. Do not say in your heart, who will sin? The do not say in your heart is a reference to Deuteronomy 9:4. And this is when they're getting ready to enter into the land. And it's fascinating that the charge that Moses gives the nation of Israel in Deuteronomy 9:4, he says, do not think in your heart that when you possess the land, that you got it because of who you were. He drives the point home that the promise of the covenant of the land was not on their faithfulness or obedience to the law, but it was on God's gracious gift by faith to them. And in Deuteronomy, Moses charges them, do not think in your heart that you get this because you have been good. Do not think in your heart that you get this because you abided by the law. You are getting this because of God's grace and faithfulness and his choice. So he starts this whole conversation when he's going into the law about that. But now he wants to make sure that they understand you do know the truth. It has been given to you. So in this section where it comes out of Deuteronomy 30, it says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend to heaven? The idea is, if I'm needing the message, where do I go get it? Do I go to heaven to get it? Or who will we send? I take this as an effort, a human effort, to gain the wisdom and knowledge that they want. In other words, who can we send to get the message to heaven? Or who can we send to heaven to get the message? His point is going to be, you and your efforts don't get to go get it. It has been given to you by me. I have given you the truth. Who can cross, one of the references says, who can cross the sea, the abyss, who can go there to get it? The idea that they tend to portray is, as a nation, what can we do to go get the message? And his point is, it is near you. It's already been given to you. It's right in front of you. You have it.
Did they
they not want it?
That's a good question. I think, let me preface this and then somebody else can chime in as well. To me, in the picture of it, it's not that they didn't want it, it's that they had a zealous nature for what was presented but had it in the wrong understanding. And therefore, they did not see this element of faith. They always saw it as a matter of works. Mm-hmm. So he's here trying to show them again, it isn't you that got it. You didn't get the land because you were good. God gave it to you. The truth is given to you, not because you sent somebody to heaven to get it or you sent somebody to the abyss to get the information and somehow draw it. It's been given to you. And that's why it says it's near. It's right in front of you.
Yeah, it's like they're looking at a gift for us and they're not taking the gift.
Yeah, and not recognizing it. Yeah, for somehow they're so zealous, they're so grounded in the law and belief that that's the only path to righteousness, they are missing it. And the result of that, if we take from the other passages, Paul realizes that their error in missing it results in their lost state. He wants them to be saved. And I think we can draw the conclusion his desire for their salvation has to be through a knowledge of understanding who Christ is.
That's right.
They have to shift from the law and recognize that this righteousness that is being offered is consistent with what the Old Testament says. They've just missed it.
The New Testament,
what they have given to them. And maybe we ought to be a little bit compassionate in the sense that they are striving to fulfill what they believe God has given them, and they're missing the mark, but it's a passion for God. I think that's why he says they have a zeal for God. It's not that they have a zeal for Satan or for evil. They have a zeal for God. That zeal is not fulfilled because they don't look at the truth. They've created a form of righteousness that God didn't intend.
They're seeing and looking for what they've been taught to see and look for.
That's true.
And it's really kind of funny because in a slightly different context and not entirely just in religion, they've studied and they found that people tend to stick to what they were first taught, even if later it's blatantly obvious that it was wrong. They just stick to it. They won't see it. It's scary what
it is. What is
it? Over 50%.
Yes. What is that? Is that a
paradigm shift that they can't?
Yes. It's a shift. They're not. There's a country song. I'd rather something be wrong. What is the line? If loving you is wrong, I'd rather be wrong than be right. It just came to my mind that the zealousness for something to, you know, that I'm going to, even if it's wrong, I'm holding on to it. I'm not giving up because.
And I've heard people even in a situation like came to a church we were going to for a while. And at one point in time, he just sort of disappeared. He sort of, I've got to go with what I've. When he had become a Christian,
yeah.
He'd been in a certain context, and he had to go with that way.
Yeah.
It didn't matter, you know. And to me, it's sort of like, well, I was raised in a way where I'm not now, you know.
Yeah.
So why do we think that way?
Yeah. Because there has to be.
These guys just got it right, and that's it.
Yeah.
You know? Well, you don't want to think you've been wrong your whole life.
No. That is a.
And I was.
Yeah. And that's a tough road, isn't it? Yeah. That change is tough. Yeah.
You don't want to think that what you thought was right. You really believed it, all of a sudden, is not.
Yeah.
Everything you based your life on, the foundation, if it's wrong, that's a huge paradigm shift to make. That's hard to do. And the Jewish nation as a whole had been taught legalism in a sense because of all the ceremonies and the festivals and the do this. And
well, they were looking back at the Levitical law that was given to them, and there were festivals and things, and they believed that following that is what would make them right. Now, one thing we got to understand that they were supposed to follow that, but they were to approach it with an attitude of faith, mm-hmm. not an attitude of legal. But there was an obligation to do that.
But you wonder how many of them before Christ really got it? If they died in the hopes of the coming Messiah, they were considered saved.
The idea is if they responded to the law in faith, as it states in the text and everything, that response in the law of faith was not based on 100% perfection in the law. It was based on the relationship of faith. So I think I would say I would not be able to go back and point to this, this, and this, but when in the Old Testament, it points to Old Testament saints and everything who were following the law but approaching it by faith, and they were seen as godly men, and points to them as examples. Now, I just want to pull your attention to this. The author of Romans is Paul. Don't forget that. How zealous was Paul for the law? And it took him getting knocked off his horse or donkey or foot, whatever it was, knocked off and a voice from heaven for him to make the paradigm shift. He had to get hit, but he was zeal. Arnie?
Piggybacking on what's been said, in the last part of Romans 9, it talks about the stumbling stone. I mean, God knew and forecast that the nation of Israel was going to stumble.
Yeah.
Zane Hodges, in looking at the word of the stumbling stone, has concluded that the, and I had changed it in my Bible, it's the stone of collision. Because the stumble is to kind of just trip a little bit but keep moving. This is one, you think of the roadrunner, you know, he's smashing into the mountain and just boom, he's stuck dead, slides on down. It's a place where the Jewish nation just came to a halt right there. They couldn't get past it and still can't.
Yep. And add on to that, just perfect, that the second part of that at the end says, it says, and the one who trusts in him, this stumbling, this will never be put to shame. So he is putting it in Christ.